Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. We're going to start off this morning by talking AI. And here's our first article, this from The Markets, from Fortune magazine, dated July 21st. China's AI labs are challenging American ones and beating them on cost. In mid-July, online sleuths who obsessively track the internet for signs of new AI models started to whisper about the latest offering from Moonshot AI, the Beijing-based artificial intelligence startup behind the Kimi large language model. Something big was coming. Moonshot AI's latest model didn't just live up to the hype. It raised the stakes, Fortune's Nicholas Gordon reports. On July 16th, Moonshot debuted Kimi K3, the largest open-source model ever released, and it promised it could perform close to the level of Anthropic's Fable 5, perhaps the most powerful publicly available model on the market today, at a fraction of the cost. Kimi K3 blew up the timeline. Chinese AI is now cheap enough and good enough that even U.S. startups and Fortune 500 companies are quietly plugging their models into their operations to rein in spiraling AI budgets. It's a remarkable closing of the gap that China achieved despite Washington imposing export controls to choke off China's access to the world's most advanced chips. And now a little more, again from Fortune magazine, this by Jason Ma, dated July 27th. The war between competing AI models could end up more like Apple versus Android than VHS versus Betamax. The tech world has been consumed recently by the debate over open weight and closed AI models, but it does not have to be a zero-sum game. The arguments cut across business, political, and safety issues. For example, lower-cost open models could take market share from closed rivals like Anthropic and OpenAI and reduce the demand for chips. U.S. AI companies also warn that Chinese open models are quickly closing the performance gap, potentially translating to a military edge, while also accusing China of stealing technology via illegal distillation. In addition, critics of open models warn they lack safety guardrails that would prevent them from being misused to develop nuclear, biological, or cyber weapons. But closed models also have their downsides too. Safety regulations could reduce competition and protect providers of closed models. Limiting access to the most advanced models also leaves users vulnerable to regulatory risk, like when the U.S. government effectively banned Anthropic's most powerful Claude models for several weeks due to security concerns. But Deutsche Bank analyst Adrian Cox put the AI debate into a more historical perspective, drawing parallels with the fight between direct current and alternating current in the 1880s, during the emergence of electrical technology. In a note last week, he also recalled the battle between VHS and Betamax video cassette players in the late 1970s and early 1980s. While Betamax was considered the superior technology, it's been relegated to the dustbin of history. The VHS format prevailed because JVC licensed it broadly, allowing a self-reinforcing ecosystem to develop around it, Cox wrote. Similarly, open-source AI doesn't have to beat closed rivals on performance, but can merely be good enough, cheaper, and ubiquitous. However, while the contest between open and proprietary AI is often presented as a winner-takes-all format, the most likely outcome is a combination of the two, he predicted. Instead of resembling VHX versus Betamax, Cox thinks the future of AI could instead look more like today's smartphones, which run on Apple's operating system and Google's Android. Both have found success and Apple's controlled premium ecosystem now coexists with a larger, more customizable one, according to Cox. Open and closed AI will also exert a positive gravitational force on each other, he said, explaining that open models will force closed competitors to curb prices and remain flexible, while closed models will continue setting the bar on quality and safety. NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang echoed this argument on Friday, saying the world needs both frontier closed models and frontier open models. He also posted a letter his company signed, along with Google, Meta, Microsoft, and even OpenAI, that also looked back to the 1980s. It said the development of open-source software at that time not only lowered costs, but also created a shared foundation of knowledge on which generations of American engineers and entrepreneurs built their institutional sovereignty. The letter added that U.S. leadership in AI shouldn't be measured by a single frontier model, but by whether the country builds a broad, open ecosystem. It acknowledged that open models carry security risks, but said the answer is maintaining access to them to bolster defenses rather than cutting off access. Open weights also strengthen competition, and competition is what keeps the gains of AI broadly shared rather than concentrated in a few hands, the letter said. By allowing many organizations to build, adapt, and deploy advanced models, open weights create rivalry, not only among model developers, but across cloud chips, applications, and services. That competition spurs innovation, drives down costs, and distributes the benefits of AI broadly across our economy. A little more on AI. And this particular article is a little bit alarming, also from Fortune magazine, dated July 28th. Greg Brockman on week two, OpenAI artificial intelligence models went rogue. Two OpenAI models escaped their testing environment and breached open source AI company Hugging Face's system. Emily Forlini talked to Greg Brockman, OpenAI co-founder and president, about the attack. Brockman told her that this incident, to some extent, is indicative of just the moment that we're in, right? He added that models have been getting so good that sometimes it's hard to lose track of any one dimension that they're actually capable of. The incident was evocative and, frankly, nightmare fodder for our society's worst fears about AI. The timing here is also notable, given the stakes. OpenAI could be set to go public as soon as this year. My money is on 2027, personally. OpenAI's prospective IPO matters, I'd argue, for everyone. It will be, maybe even more so than an Anthropic IPO, the quintessential test of the AI bubble. OpenAI's massive consumer reach, reportedly dicey margins, and narrative importance in the AI boom make it a perfect prism through which investors of all kinds will ask the same question: is it all worth it? What will a sustainable business model in AI actually look like? There are two parts to that, Brockman said. One is, let's suppose model capabilities were frozen today. What is the business? I think OpenAI is the most strongly positioned right now for that scenario. We have ChatGPT, which has nearly a billion users, and there is so much more value we can deliver to those users through even just the technology that exists today. So, part one seems to be, if you have scale and adoption, you'll be able to leverage that. I have some skepticism on this point. Anecdotally, it's pretty clear to me at a consumer and individual level, people are willing to jump from model to model as it suits them. Scale doesn't promise retention. That being said, Brockman does have a point. Scale is a business, and it can certainly buy you time. Brockman's second point was probably more consequential. Model progress isn't fundamentally stalled. large language models will keep getting better. The way to think about it is a little less like we have electricity now, LLMs, and now we need to build a washing machine, businesses on top of the LLMs, he told Chantel. Just like people are trying to achieve fusion, we're trying to get the technology to do something that is very qualitatively different from what has been done before. The fundamental value delivery that we're after, we're not there yet. The massive value creation is yet to come. Some of it will wind up being the value that AI labs have, but some of it will accrue to the world. Embedded in this point, Brockman implies something that's not just true for OpenAI, but is true for all startups building in this era. We sincerely don't know what the business model of the future is or what sustainable AI unit economics can look like. And if the past and present tell us anything, it's that at least some won't know until it's too late. Until then, it'll be a battle. And now, as an extension of the AI market, we're going to talk about chip makers. This from Fortune magazine, dated July 27th. China's CXMT wipes the floor with rival chip makers. U.S. futures were down only marginally prior to the open in New York, after European markets eked out some gains, perhaps signaling a pause in the collapse of semiconductor stocks globally that we've seen over the last 24 hours. Dutch chipmaker ASML declined 5.8% yesterday and is down another 3.48% in overnight trading. After CXMT debuted on the stock market in China, Micron, Intel, and TSMC all took hits as well. CXMT also gave up 4% today, but that came after a run-up of nearly 500% yesterday. On South Korea's highly volatile KOSPI, SK Hynix lost 14.65% and Samsung declined 13.39%. Having undercut everything from steel to cars, it now looks like China is coming for the chip fabricators. Chief market analyst Chris Beauchamp of trading platform IG told Fortune in an email, "Nothing is more likely to prompt a rout in a tech name than suggestions that China is poised to produce a homegrown version." The chip sell-off went global overnight, the strategy team at Saxo said this morning, mounting doubts over returns on AI capital spending sent semiconductors lower for a third session, with MSCI's Asian Pacific gauge dropping as much as 3.6%, to its lowest since May. NVIDIA's fresh round of deals, worth more than $750 billion, has raised questions over circular funding, and a report that a Chinese state-backed firm, as yet unnamed, has begun mass-producing immersion DUV lithography machines added yet another competitive threat. So you've graduated with a degree in engineering. What is your future job prospects going to look like? Here's a quick article from Forbes magazine, its Daily Double. Though it's been long considered a safe path to a high-paying role, an engineering degree is no longer a guarantee in today's difficult job market. Hiring of new graduates overall fell 20% between December 2019 and April of 2026, according to LinkedIn data provided exclusively to Forbes. But for engineering majors, jobs were down by 25%, the largest drop of any of the 20 most common majors on LinkedIn's platform. There was a time when we told everybody to code, and we thought that was a very safe role, said Corey Cantenga, LinkedIn's head of Economics Americas. And now we see for folks who graduated with computer science degrees, unemployment is relatively elevated. And now three quick headlines. Number one, President Donald Trump threatened to impose tariffs on the European Union in retaliation for its fines against American tech companies, saying the U.S. will investigate and reverse the penalties. Number two, Paramount's Skydance will delay its $110 billion merger with Warner Brothers Discovery until 2027, after a judge temporarily blocked it amid a legal challenge from 12 states. And the final headline, chipmaker CXMT, whose memory chips have been sought by Apple, briefly became mainland China's most valuable publicly traded listed company in its blockbuster trading debut on Monday. And now an article on a problem that you and I will probably never have. This is from Fortune magazine. It's the daily cover story. The title of the article is, and this will be self-explanatory as to why you and I may never have this problem, Inside the Seas Superyacht Fiasco That's Costing Taxpayers Millions. In the frantic months after Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine, 11 Western governments froze or detained at least 20 Russian-linked superyachts, valued at roughly $4.3 billion at the time. It was a masterclass in wartime PR, suggesting swift justice, confiscate, sell, and use the proceeds to help rebuild Ukraine. That didn't happen. Instead, the campaign turned into a bureaucratic boondoggle. Legally speaking, freezing a yacht is not the same as confiscating it, which is required before it can be sold. Over the years, only 4 of those superyachts have been confiscated, 3 of which were sold at discounts. According to Forbes estimates, only 2 governments, those of the U.S. and Antigua and Barbuda, have gotten any cash from yacht sales after accounting for costs. None of it appears to have gone to the Ukraine. 2 other yachts were quietly unfrozen and released back to their owners. Meanwhile, Western taxpayers continue to foot the bills for several of the remaining 15 yachts, still tied up in ports across Europe. To uncover the true costs of this failed strategy, Forbes filed freedom of information requests with government agencies in 11 countries, scoured court records, and spoke with lawyers, yacht brokers, and shipyards. A number of American government agencies have not gotten back to us, and several other nations, including Italy and Germany, refuse to provide any information. Despite the secrecy, Forbes verified that governments have paid more than $100 million, maintaining just 5 yachts. For the remaining yachts, Forbes worked with superyacht market data firm Phronesis Superyacht Intelligence and Insight to come up with the independent estimate of the costs. In total, the 4-year yacht freezing odyssey has so far cost an estimated $390 million, with U.S. taxpayers footing at least $50 million, the second largest part of the bill. More than 4 years after Western governments started detaining and seizing the superyachts of Russian oligarchs, the campaign's objectives have clearly failed, said Forbes deputy editor Giacomo Tognini. The war in Ukraine is still raging. The targeted billionaires are richer than they were before the war, and taxpayers are stuck footing the bill for several vessels that are rotting in the water or stuck where they were when they were frozen. Some are still being paid for by their sanctioned owners, and others have just been abandoned. And the precious few that were seized and sold, it appears that none of the proceeds made it to Ukraine. Next, we're going to expand on one of the headlines we gave just a moment ago, this from Fortune magazine by Sam McDeal, dated July 27th. EU strikes Google with a $1 billion fine in major crackdown on antitrust regulations, even as Trump threatens retaliation. The European Union on Thursday hit Google with a fine of 890 million euros, that's $1 billion, after it said the technology behemoth broke digital antitrust regulations by setting up Google Play and its ubiquitous search engine to corral consumers toward its own services and apps to the detriment of consumers. It was the latest major crackdown on big tech in Brussels, which has led the world in reining in some of the world's largest companies from Silicon Valley to Beijing. It's done so despite the risk of incurring the wrath of President Donald Trump, who's lashed out at the 27-nation bloc's digital regulations amid a broader campaign against Europe, imposing high tariffs, making threats to seize Greenland from Denmark by force, and rattling trust within the NATO military alliance. In the past, Trump has threatened retaliation if American tech companies are penalized. Google has recently lost its appeal of a $4.5 billion antitrust fine imposed by the EU for throttling competition and reducing consumer choice through the dominance of its mobile Android operating system. The European Commission, the bloc's executive branch and highest antitrust enforcer, said it was acting in the interest of consumers after an investigation of Google. The best products should succeed because they're better, not because they're owned by the company running the search engine. And European consumers have a right to be told by app developers where to sign up to the best offers, even when the app store owner does not get a cut, said Teresa Ribera, the Commission Executive Vice President for Clean, Just, and Competitive Transition. Google's President of Global Affairs, Kent Walker, blasted the fine as product degradation driven by a small group of self-serving complainants that'll have a negative impact on European businesses and consumers. He said that the EU's Digital Market Act forces Google to strip away real-time search features that Europeans love, like instant pricing and direct availability for hotels, flights, and restaurants, and dismantle safety protections on Google Play. The EU describes the world's seven tech giants, Amazon, Apple, Google parent Alphabet, Meta, Microsoft, and TikTok owner ByteDance, as gatekeepers that control access for consumers. In the EU, businesses have the right to compete fairly. Gatekeepers have the obligation to ensure a level playing field and consumers the right to choose for cheaper alternative offers, said European Commission spokesperson Thomas Regnier. Alphabet reported $403 billion in revenue in 2025. You may be asking yourself, as the Ukraine-Russia war grinds on, how is the economy of Russia performing? Here's an article from Fortune magazine, dated July 20th, by Jason Ma. Putin finally admits that Russia's economy is in trouble and grasps for answers after warnings about a financial crisis have been piling up. Russian President Vladimir Putin made his concerns about the economy public as he vented frustration at aides and demanded they come up with solutions. During a televised meeting on the economy Wednesday, he revealed that GDP shrank by a combined 1.8% in January and February, adding that manufacturing, industrial production, and construction were negative. I expect to hear detailed reports today on the current economic situation and why the trajectory of macroeconomic indicators is currently below expectations, Putin said. Moreover, below the expectations of not only experts and analysts, but also the forecasts of the government itself and the Central Bank of Russia. The meeting was attended by Prime Minister Mikhail Mishustin, Kremlin Deputy Chief of Staff Maxim Oreshkin, First Deputy Prime Minister Denis Manturov, Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak, Central Bank Governor Elvira Nebulina, and the CEO of PSB Bank. Russian economy has already been slowing down as Putin's war on Ukraine continues to keep inflation high and the labor market tight. An economic contraction would be the first since 2022, when Russia invaded Ukraine and was hit by Western sanctions that slashed energy exports. Massive military spending helped GDP expand by 4.1% in 2023 and 4.9% in 2024, But weak oil revenue and deeper deficits forced Moscow to limit defense outlays. GDP grew by just 1% last year, and the Kremlin earlier predicted 1.3% growth this year. Meanwhile, the Kremlin's budget deficit widened to $58.6 billion in the first quarter as oil tax revenue in March dropped by half compared to a year ago. To be sure, the Iran war sent oil prices soaring, and the Trump administration has lifted sanctions on Russian oil, setting up Moscow for a revenue windfall. But Ukraine's relentless drone attacks on Russian export hubs have prevented Russia from fully capitalizing on its opportunity. Following Putin's scolding of his aides on Wednesday, the central bank chief said Thursday that Russia's unemployment rate remained at historic lows of 2%, as the war created a lack of available workers, forcing employers to compete for staff. This peculiarity of the current situation is, for the first time in modern history, our economy has faced shortages or limits on labor, Nabulina added. This is a new reality for the government and for business alike. In the past, high-rate cycles were tied to temporary external shocks, and once things stabilized, we cut rates fairly quickly. Now, however, we're facing a persistent downturn in external conditions affecting both exports and imports. The tight labor market has stoked inflation and kept benchmark interest rates high. Although the central bank has recently eased them a bit, they've caused strains in the economy and the financial system, prompting a series of warnings. Earlier this year, Russian officials told Putin that a financial crisis could hit by the summer amid spiraling inflation. With companies feeling the squeeze of high rates and weaker consumption, more workers were going unpaid, getting furloughed, or seeing their hours cut. As a result, consumers were having trouble servicing their loans, raising concerns of a crash in the financial sector. A banking crisis is possible, a Russian official told the Washington Post in December, on condition of anonymity. A non-payment crisis is possible. I don't want to think about a continuation of the war or an escalation. The Center for Macroeconomic Analysis and Short-Term Forecasting, a state-backed Russian think tank, also said in December the country could face a banking crisis by October if loan troubles worsen and depositors pull out their funds. In June, Russian banks raised red flags on a potential debt crisis as high interest rates weighed on borrowers' ability to pay off loans. Also in that month, the head of the Russian Union of Industrialists and Entrepreneurs warned that many companies were in a pre-default situation. Here's a new medical development that may lead to an entirely new market. This is from Fortune magazine, dated July 27th, by Amy Feldman. Peptides may soon be legal. These companies are ready to cash in. When the FDA panel that's considering whether to recommend legal production of seven peptides meets starting Thursday, Sean Nurian will be at its Maryland campus in person. I wouldn't miss this for the world. Nurian, the founder and CEO of Houston-based Empower Pharmacy, one of the nation's largest compounding pharmacies, tells Forbes. The who's who of the peptide space will be there. Hundreds of others are expected to jam into the room as well, including compounders, telehealth founders, and longevity influencers who are flying in for the event. It'll be a circus, said Scott Bruner, CEO of the Alliance for Pharmacy Compounding, the industry's trade group. Everybody and their brother will be there. While these peptides are currently not legal to produce for anything other than research purposes, that hasn't stopped a booming gray market for exploiting that loophole. There's little scientific data on their safety and efficacy, and the many sketchy sellers who distribute them operate with no oversight, Still, the illicit peptide market could be worth an estimated $3 billion. Silicon Valley Brothers, Longevity Medics, and Maha Believers take them while wellness influence promote their peptide stacks to speed recovery and improve sleep. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is a self-described big fan of peptides, as he told podcaster Joe Rogan in February. While peptides are a broad category of amino-based drugs that include well-known legal ones like insulin and the GLP-1 weight loss drugs, the buzz and the FDA panel is focused on a bunch of them known by a string of letters and numbers. These are the injectables like BPC-157, which is extremely popular online for its reputed ability to heal tendons, ligaments, and muscles, and TB-500, which is believed to reduce inflammation and improve wound healing. This is akin to the supplement industry, said Michelle Davy, founder and CEO of telehealth company Wheel. I feel like it'll be the Wild West for the first 6 months at least. Kennedy has argued that legalizing these substances would make them safer by moving Americans away from the existing gray market. There is some truth to that. When people buy peptides directly from China or other countries, there's a risk of contamination, incorrect dosing, or other problems, and buyers can't easily tell if they've actually gotten the peptide they've purchased. But legalization would also make these substances, whose efficacy hasn't been proven, more readily available, and give them a stamp of approval. That's why the FDA's own technical staff has recommended against expanded access, and the Public Health Group Partnership for Safe Medicines calls them popular, unproven, dangerous, as Peter Kolchinski, managing partner of biotech investor RA Capital Management, puts it. Is the FDA going to stand on science, or is it going to permit all kinds of snake oil to be made readily available? The meeting will last 2 days. The panel is widely expected to recommend allowing compounders to make at least some of the 7 peptides under review in what some online commentators are calling Peptide Liberation Day. Another 5 peptides are slated for consideration in 2027. The panel makes its recommendations to the FDA, which will then determine whether to begin the process of approving these peptides. That approval could take as little as a few months or longer than a year. For compounding pharmacies like Empower, telehealth giant Hims and Hers, and a slew of others, which can concoct drugs specifically for individual patients, that puts a potential multi-billion-dollar-a-year market within reach. We'd love to make them, and we're getting ready to do it, says Mike Walker, co-founder and president of Strive Pharmacy, another major compounder. We're just waiting for the green light from the FDA. Compounding pharmacies are in some ways a throwback. A century ago, 3/4 of prescription required some sort of in-pharmacy compounding, mixing up drug formulations in the shop rather than giving a patient a standard off-the-shelf medication. But that number dropped to 1% by the 1970s. In the last 2 decades, compounding found new life, with the boom in testosterone for men, hormone replacement therapy for women, and more recently, GLP-1 weight loss drugs. Compounders are required to follow regulations about manufacturing, but the drugs they produce are not FDA approved. Nurian, a former mechanical engineer, founded Empower Pharmacy in 2009 after using a compounded medicine to treat his own low testosterone at age 24. Today it has 2 manufacturing facilities in Houston, comprising 212,000 square feet. Its expansion has not been without issues. Empower has received multiple warning letters from the FDA about quality concerns. Empower says it takes every inspection seriously. Strive Pharmacy, founded by Walker and his childhood friend Nate Hill in Utah in 2018, acquired a 275,000 square foot manufacturing and outsourcing facility in Alachua, Florida in November. In December, it broke ground on a new 350,000 square foot headquarters and advanced compounding plant in Mesa, Arizona, that's expected to open in early 2027. Across the country, compounding pharmacies like Houston-based Revive RX and Fort Lauderdale-based Hollandale have sprung up or expanded, while private equity-backed Revelation Pharma has been rolling up compounding pharmacies into a large operation. Him and Hers, the $7.6 billion market cap telehealth giant, even acquired its own compounding pharmacy in September of 2024. These compounders boomed in recent years, especially as GLP weight loss drugs became so popular that they were deemed to be in shortage. Compounding pharmacies could legally make them to fill the gap. The shift to telehealth also made compounded drugs, which are generally cheaper, easier to get. But when the GLP-1 shortages subsided, a huge chunk of compounders' business was suddenly in jeopardy. Some kept selling GLP-1 knockoffs anyway, leading regulators to crack down on false advertising and bootleg sales. GLP pharma giants Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk slapped some of them with lawsuits. For compounders who'd shunned the GLP-1 space due to its legal risk, and to those who were seeing their business in that area dwindle, peptides are the obvious answer. For the players who built their infrastructure around GLP-1s, this is the place to go, said Wheels Davy. Importantly, no pharma companies own any patents on the peptides under consideration. No one can say these medications should be made by traditional pharma companies, Nurian said. It won't just be compounders who get into the game, Davy says. She believes non-traditional healthcare players and manufacturers of vitamins and supplements will try to seize the opportunity too. John Lansing, CEO of Open Loop, a VC-backed startup that runs telehealth operations for customers under their own brand names, says that his customers, including large gym chains, have been asking about peptides. Patients want convenience, he says. Why should a gym not open up access? The land grab has investors looking for ways to get in, too. We're already having clients positioning themselves for it, said Jesse Dresser, a partner at Fryer Levy. The compounders and the telehealth companies, the targets, so to speak, are in talks right now with private equity groups and with VC firms. To prepare for the FDA decision, Nurian says that Empower has been prepping for months, including doing R&D to ensure that its formulations are stable and that it can offer peptides as injections, pills, and nasal sprays to meet expected demand. He figures that Empower's revenue from peptides could eventually reach several hundred million dollars. Him and Hers is also currently building out its infrastructure and clinical protocols to be ready to produce and sell peptides if they should gain approval. Industry Watch is expected to be one of the largest players in the space, given its scale. Last month, the company brought on Dr. Anant Vinjamuri, a Harvard-trained longevity expert, as chief medical officer of HIMS. One focus, the company's strategy for peptide therapy. Even if the FDA's committee recommends in favor of peptides this week, it's unclear that the timing would be for their ultimate approval. Then, too, turning on supply chains for them won't be so simple. Because these peptides aren't currently legal for consumers, the only active pharmaceutical ingredients now available are research-grade ones that aren't permitted in human drugs, explains Bruner of the Compounding Industry Trade Group. Setting up pharmaceutical ingredient supply chains that adhere to the complex regulations on manufacturing and quality could take months, or perhaps longer, if the administration were to require them to be sourced in the United States rather than in China. Everybody can cheer and rah-rah and hope the FDA approves these substances, Bruner said. The dilemma that many aren't talking about is managing the supply chain. But the market is simply too enticing. Given the number of peptides that we're talking about, this has the potential to make the experience we've just gone through with GLP-1s look little by comparison. We have yet another AI article now, this one from Fortune magazine dated July 27th by Amanda Garut. Amazon's $25 billion surprise bond sale dangled extra yield to lure in buyers and flashed a warning sign about the AI boom. Bond investors haven't been rattled as they've watched AI giants rack up $270 billion in debt this year. But on Tuesday, Amazon gave them a shake. The company plunked what Bank of America called a surprise $25 billion bond sale on the market on July 7th, bringing the amount of debt issued by the tech giant to $92 billion this year, surpassing the amounts that Alphabet's Google, Meta, and Oracle have issued this year. To get the deal done, Amazon had to sweeten the terms, offering 18 to 21 basis points of extra yield on its longest bond. Yet even with sugar on top, Amazon's debt offering drew the weakest demand, with orders at just 2.5 times the bonds on offer, down from 3.2 times in March, according to B of A. Amazon's overall new issue performance was the weakest for any hyperscaler since Meta's $30 billion bond sale in October of 2025. Investors are pushing back, B of A wrote in its note. The deal should also inject even more uncertainty into the hyperscaler AI supply outlook. Amazon still had more buyers of its investment-grade debt. Credit agency Moody's rates it AA, the third highest rating. S&P rates it S1, its fifth highest. Then it sold in Tuesday's deal. But the slowing level of demand could be a warning sign about the future of the AI boom. So far this year, bonds related to AI are already almost double the debt value in the sector issued in 2025, which was $136 billion for the full year. Among the AI industry's $270 billion issued, Bank of A estimates that $194 billion is from so-called hyperscalers, the tech giants who build and operate massive data centers to power their online services and rent cloud computing capacity to other businesses. Besides Amazon, the other hyperscalers include Alphabet, Meta, Microsoft, and Oracle. They've all announced plans for enormous capital expenditures to fund their AI-related ambitions. Alphabet even issued century-long bonds when it raised $30 billion earlier this year. Amazon's cash grab will go to fund its rapidly growing cloud computing business, Amazon Web Services, AWS. At the company's last earning call in April, CEO Andy Jassy told analysts that the faster Amazon's cloud computing business grows, the more short-term capital expenditure Amazon will have. AWS has to pay for land, power, buildings, chips, servers, and networking gear in advance before it can profit 6 months to 2 years down the road, Jassy said during the call. Amazon's CapEx totaled $43.2 billion in the first quarter alone, Chief Financial Officer Brian Olsavsky said on the same call, and he said it was directed toward both AWS and generative AI. The mega spending is hurting Amazon's cash flows, with its free cash flow over the trailing 12 months down to $1.2 billion, compared to $25.9 billion a year ago. The decline was driven by a year-over-year increase in property and equipment purchases of $59.3 billion, according to Amazon's quarter one 2026 figures. However, Amazon still spun up $148.5 billion in operating cash flow, up 30% over last year. But the bond market is clearly taking note. Amazon issued bonds in eight tranches, ranging from 3 to 40 years, according to B of A. And hyperscaler bond spreads expanded between 6 and 15 basis points that day. Amazon's bond deal even helped lift the 10-year Treasury yield up 8 basis points, B of A noted. Wider spreads and slightly weaker demand signals that AI build-out might be moving slightly faster than the speed at which investors are willing to soak up all of this debt. Yet B of A wrote that the pushback isn't too significant at this point. Heavy spending is mostly expected, and demand is robust. Amazon will next report earnings either later this month or in early August. As many of you already know, the Federal Reserve had its every 6 weeks meeting today, and they made a decision with regard to interest rates. I'm going to read you a couple of short articles on this. The first, Fed meeting live updates. Warsh said the Fed will not hesitate to act on inflation. Here's the subheadline to that. The committee had a good family fight, Warsh says. Fed Chairman Kevin Warsh, across five public appearances, has used the phrase family fight 13 times, and he used it again to acknowledge the three dissents. The vote, by the way, was 9-3 to hold rates steady. The three dissents over the central bank's July interest decision. I asked for a good family fight, and I got one, he said. Most of our discussions were on the big questions that matter to the conduct of monetary policy. We didn't sort of hide from them. We weren't scared of them. There was a lot more interaction between and among my clients. It was a real family fight. While the majority of members of the Federal Open Market Committee agreed that holding rates steady in July, three dissented, arguing instead to hike rates to combat above-target inflation. Now, going a bit further, here's a comment from Thornburg's Hoffman. Fed delivers an uncomfortable hold. While the Fed held rates steady, the three dissents in the committee resulted in an uncomfortable hold, according to Christian Hoffman, head of fixed income at Thornburg Investment Management. I'm calling this an uncomfortable hold, Hoffman said. Hoffman noted that the decision follows some constructive inflation readings, but he noted that oil is again rising as the conflict between the U.S. and Iran heats up once more. Some more AI commentary here. This from Fortune magazine on its daily newsletter, dated July 27th. Insiders knew that one day advanced AI models would escape the lab and wreak havoc. There's an open secret among AI developers. An incident like the one in which two open AI models escaped from a supposedly secure environment and hacked a rival AI company has been expected for a long time. And the best scientists and engineers in the world still don't know how to prevent it, writes Helen Toner, a former AI board member. None of the current policies aimed at managing risks from frontier models would have mandated that the public or even a government entity be alerted. This lays bare an enormous blind spot in current policy approaches to managing risks for increasingly advanced AI systems. allowing the government to review new model releases won't fix the problem, because that still ignores the most advanced, unreleased AI systems inside AI companies. As last week's incident shows, these internally deployed AI systems can pose serious risks, even for third parties. The solution: draw inspiration from other industries where activity inside the industry is itself risky. Biological labs working with deadly pathogens, finance companies trading billions of dollars, and chemical plants handling toxic chemicals all face oversight for their internal operations, not just their external product. Some more information on the financial side of the AI boom, again from Fortune Magazine Daily Newsletter, July 27th. Wall Street is starting to see hyperscaler CapEx, that's capital expenditure, as more of a problem than a solution. Here's a simple explanation for why tech stocks have been so rattled recently. Analysts keep adjusting upward their estimates of what AI hyperscalers will spend on CapEx in the future, and that increased spend is driving down free cash flow estimates. Investors don't like it when they see companies deliberately reducing their profits, hence all the selling in the market. The other problem, according to Wells Fargo Obsung Kwon, is that the market is concerned around the risk of eventual CapEx cuts if return on investment isn't there, he said in an email, emphasis added. Given that both semiconductor chip companies and AI hyperscalers are essentially making the same bet that AI will drive revenues and profits, you can see why investors might be nervous at any sign that those profits are being pushed further and further into the future. And here's a short one from Forbes in the Daily Dozen, dated July 29th. You've heard of leasing a car, and now there's a new way to lease your next iPhone, too. Apple and Klarna announced a program Tuesday that will allow customers to lease rather than purchase the tech giant's products, including iPhones, Apple Watches, iPads, and Macs. Monthly payments start at $17.99 per month for the iPhone for 12 to 24 month periods. The financing option comes as consumers have turned to the growing buy now, pay later industry to help offset rising prices. Apple, which became only the second company in history to reach a $5 trillion market cap on Tuesday, has continued to raise the cost of its products this year. And finally, an article about oil pricing. Try not to get too depressed as I read this. This is from Fortune Magazine by Jordan Bloom, dated July 28th. Trump has no remaining levers to pull as oil hovers near the $100 psychological threshold. President Donald Trump is essentially out of levers to pull during a second phase of the Iran war as oil price again flirt with the $100 per barrel psychological threshold that makes energy markets jittery. With global oil and fuel emergency reserves already dwindled, and fighting spreading to the Red Sea, Saudi Arabia's alternate outlet for oil exports, the concern is the U.S. faces either escalation or capitulation, energy and geopolitical analysts said. That means expanding the military operation to include so-called boots on the ground, or ceding the now infamous Strait of Hormuz to Iran to control and charge de facto tolls, call servicer administration fees in a thinly veiled effort to avoid violating international maritime laws. The big question is now whether Trump, after some short-term period of escalation, will choose the so-called taco route, said Dan Pickering, founder of the Pickering Energy Partners consulting and research firm. The Trump always chickens out term was coined last year, after Trump repeatedly backed down from higher tariffs and other threats, and market sentiment remained that something will likely have to give well before the November midterm elections. You either taco or you turn up the heat, and things get worse before they get better, Pickering told Fortune. If you think that the midterms are just the pressure point, doing something that influenced prices and sentiment in the short run just looks challenging. After the interim peace deal was shredded and the military conflict escalated earlier this month, oil prices rapidly rose back above $100 per barrel before dipping back below on Friday after the Yemeni Houthis opened fire on two Saudi Arabian tankers in the Red Sea's Bab el-Mandeb Strait. The U.S. and the rest of the world has depleted most of its energy reserves. A gas tax holiday is unlikely because it requires approval from a splintered Congress. U.S. oil producers and refiners are already churning out products near all-time highs, and the administration has already waived the Jones Act, allowing more ships to move fuel from the U.S. Gulf Coast to the more barren west and east coasts. Elsewhere, China has dramatically decreased its oil imports, keeping prices from spiraling near record highs. Most of these things have already been put in place in round one, Pickering said. There's not a lot of other demand levers that you can pull. If both the Bab el-Mandeb and the Strait of Hormuz are nearly shuttered, Pickering said, the oil price could easily rise in August back to the near late April price of $124 a barrel. Already, the average price of a gallon of regular unleaded in the United States is back above $4.10 and rising. But the clock is ticking and the math is publicly available data. Just look at the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve, the SPR. The SPR peaked above 726 million barrels during the last week of 2009, and it's down nearly 60% to 311 million barrels as of last week, the lowest level since early 1983 when it was first being filled up. The SPR was at 415 million barrels as recently as late March, losing more than 100 million barrels in just the last 4 months. The U.S. Department of Energy recently countered that cavern mechanics would allow the SPR to go as low as 70 million barrels. Even if that's technically accurate, it would still become much more challenging to extract the oil well below 250 million barrels, likely leaving any technical minimum irrelevant, and oil markets are not interested in even flirting with such low numbers. So, what's the solution? Your answer is to get a deal with the Iranians, and they don't seem to want to make a deal. And with that, folks, we're done. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. Thanks for listening. See you next Monday at 11. Bye for now.